I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, cabinet selections. President-elect Trump makes history selecting his chief of staff. We're at the White House. Balance of power. A handful of congressional races have not yet been called. How the outcomes could affect the president-elect's agenda. Collapse of communism. A look back on the 35th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the role played by St. John Paul II. And on the money, a World Series wager between two church leaders makes a big donation to a good cause. We'll explain these stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, as Donald Trump prepares to return to the White House for a second term, both the incoming and outgoing administrations are adjusting to the power change. The process of ushering in a brand new government is underway, and that includes President-elect Trump selecting his next White House chief of staff. Trump says that she will make the country proud. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, good evening to you. The next White House Chief of Staff, a very powerful position, will be veteran Florida political strategist Susie Wiles, who was also Trump's campaign co-chair. She will be the president's closest advisor and counsel, and also the gatekeeper to his office. This as the wheels of change start moving.
Thank you very much. Wow.
After his big win over Vice President Kamala Harris and a political comeback for the ages, President-elect Donald Trump and his transition team now moving ahead with moving back into the White House. Alongside him will be Susie Wiles, his 2024 campaign manager, seen here with Trump celebrating the election night win. Later, Trump writing about his new chief of staff saying, "Susie Wiles just helped me achieve one of the greatest political victories in American history," and Susie is tough, smart, innovative, and is universally admired and respected. Susie will continue to work tirelessly to make America great again. Meanwhile, as the Biden administration prepares to vacate, the U.S. State Department spokesman addresses reporters, telling them Thursday, "The peaceful transfer of power is an essential element of our democracy that is vital to our nation's security."
That's why it's so important for us to conduct a smooth, efficient, and professional transition process.
And between now and January 20th, Matthew Miller also emphasized, they will have no shortage of work to do and are determined to make the most of the time left, including
ensuring that Ukraine is in the best position possible for success and bringing an end to the fighting in Lebanon and Gaza while improving the delivery of humanitarian assistance, securing the release of all hostages, and preventing the further spread of the conflict.
And at the Pentagon, the deputy press secretary beginning Thursday's briefing with this statement.
In a message to the force, Secretary Austin emphasized that the department will make a calm, orderly, and professional transition to the next commander-in-chief.
And she added, the U.S. military
will stand ready to carry out the policy choices of its next commander-in-chief and to obey all lawful orders from its civilian chain of command.
Now, Trump, in his letter that I referred to in that report, pointed out that Susan Summerall Wiles will be the first ever female chief of staff in U.S. history. And if the name Summerall rings a bell, she is the daughter of NFL player and sportscaster Pat Summerall. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, the Justice Department brings criminal charges against three people in Iran's alleged murder-for-hire plot against the president-elect. According to the charges, a member of Tehran's Revolutionary Guard instructed a contact to kill Trump as part of plots to target several U.S. government officials. And we all know Republicans will take control of the U.S. Senate come January, but by how much? Well, that is still undecided. And right now, they have at least 53 seats, the largest majority in years. And they will soon pick a new GOP leader to preside over the majority. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. Yes, 53 seats so far. The latest pickup was for Republicans was in Pennsylvania. Longtime Democratic Senator Bob Casey, a Catholic, was defeated by Republican challenger Dave McCormick. Now, Casey was going for his fourth term. He had yet to concede the race, putting out a statement today saying that every legitimate vote must be counted. Senator-elect McCormick says Pennsylvanians wanted a change in direction.
They, I think they represented that desire for change by electing President Trump. I think the same with me. They're deeply distressed by the skyrocketing prices, the wide open border, the crime in our cities, the war on fossil fuels, and they want change and common sense leadership.
McCormick, a former hedge fund manager and Gulf War veteran, won by a half of a percent. Just today, McCormick and his team filed a lawsuit challenging the 15,000 to 20,000 provisional ballots in Philadelphia that need to be counted in the coming days. McCormick currently leads Casey by only some 30,000 votes, 49% to 48.5%. Meanwhile, Democrats continue to analyze how they lost the majority in the Senate. Senator Chris Coons says the COVID pandemic played a major role.
I think there is a populist and a anti-incumbent wave because of the impact of both the pandemic and the recovery from it. And I think President Biden did a strong and a capable, even a masterful job of pulling us out of the economic depths of the pandemic.
Next week, Senate Republicans will pick a new majority leader. Senator Bill Cassidy says whoever it is, Republicans must work together.
My number one priority is making certain we have a leader that aligns our Senate with the incredible challenge that we've got in the next 100, 200 days of turning our nation back around, of working arm in arm with President Trump as he puts executive orders together, as we put a reconciliation package together, hopefully.
Senators John Cornyn of South Dakota and John Cornyn of Texas and John Thune of South Dakota are main contenders, but Senator Rick Scott of Florida is also vying for the job. He wants President-elect Donald Trump to endorse him, but some are saying that they don't want Trump to endorse anyone because all it's going to do is cause division among Republicans. And take a look at this. This afternoon, Ohio senator turned vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance made a stop on Capitol Hill. We tried to get a comment on who he might want to lead the Republican-led Senate, but he just waved and pretty much acted like he was on his cell phone and made his way up to his office without a comment. That's about the most action Capitol Hill has seen in weeks, but all that could change when lawmakers arrive back to the Hill next week. Reporting from the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, as President-elect Trump prepares to return to the White House, it is becoming more and more apparent that he received a huge boost from Catholic-identified voters after Catholics split fairly evenly between Trump and President Biden back in 2020. On Tuesday, they broke for Trump by about 15 points. The Harris campaign skipped Catholic fundraising dinner, the Al Smith dinner in New York, and refused to consider religious exemptions for abortion. In addition to Catholics, Trump also improved his margins among Latino and Black Americans. And here to break this all down for us is Peter Lavin, staff writer for the National Catholic Register, who recently wrote a piece outlining Trump's demographic gains. Peter, great to see you again. In your article for the Register, I know you mentioned the appeal to Catholic voters that each candidate made. Talk to us a little bit more about why there was such a disparity.
Well, it was a huge disparity, and it's very rare in an election that we see a swing this big, either with Latinos or Catholics or any demographic group. And we can point to some of the outreach efforts of the candidates as evidence, or at least as some sort of cause as to why this happened. I think two major things we can point to that happened that allowed Trump to bring in this coalition. And the first thing is that he just had an overall better message on the economy and on immigration. And those two issues were the most important things in this election for all voters, including voters of color. And this is an amazing stat. He won voters of color overall. One third of all voters of color in the nation. So an amazing turnaround with Trump in a minority vote and in Catholic voters as well. And the other thing is, I think the Harris campaign just made some very, very bad impressions on Catholic voters of all stripes in the last few weeks of the campaign. I know last time I was on this program, we talked about the Gretchen Whitmer controversy in Michigan, and that didn't go well for Catholic voters, for Democrats getting Catholic voters in Michigan. But the other big one was the ad that the Trump campaign ran continuously in swing states that showed Kamala Harris talking to a journalist saying she would want taxpayer-funded sex change operations for criminals. And the clip was in her voice, and it was played on a loop repeatedly. And I think that went really far in turning off Catholic voters.
Yeah, I have a question for you about this. Trump's election of J.D. Vance as his running mate, do you think that helped to appeal to Catholic voters?
It's hard to say if that selection helped him appeal to Catholic voters, but I think it's fair to say that J.D. Vance became a much stronger vice presidential nominee as this process unfolded. In the last few weeks, especially, he was able to speak to Catholic voters in terms of, hey, this person on the other side of this, Kamala Harris, has a really abysmal record on religious freedom. He wrote an op-ed for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about 2 weeks before the election, making this case, saying, hey, this person has come out very strongly during Senate hearings about people who have any kind of a connection to Knights of Columbus. I think he did a better job as the race went on in courting Catholic voters, yes.
Yeah, and what do you think are some of maybe the top issues that Catholics would like to see tackled in this upcoming administration?
You know, funny enough, I think agriculture is going to be a big deal. I think Robert F. Kennedy's role in health and human services is going to be a big deal. And I think Catholic voters, just like all other voters, they want to see inflation come down. They want to see the border dealt with. And this is an incredible thing, especially about Latino Catholics who swung for Trump in a very big way. They trusted Trump on immigration more than they trusted Harris. And so we're going to expect to see some action on this. It's an incredible fact, thinking back 10 years ago, when Trump came down the golden escalator and began talking about the border in a way that many pundits thought, okay, this is going to turn off Latino voters forever, and they actually ended up favoring him on the issue. So I think he's got a real mandate to act on the border, and I think Catholics are right to be concerned about it.
Well, Peter, great to have you on the show again. Good to see you. God bless.
Thank you. God bless you.
Our Russian President Vladimir Putin says that he is ready for dialogue with President-elect Trump, adding that Trump's comments on ending the war in Ukraine, quote, deserve attention at the very least. Putin also says that Trump has a desire to rebuild relations with Russia. This comes as Ukraine's leader says that North Korean troops are helping Russian soldiers in fighting in Russia's Kursk region. Dozens of people are arrested in attacks on Israeli soccer fans in Amsterdam. Take a look at this alarming scene there. On the night of violence erupted after a soccer game between a visiting Israeli team and a local club. Israeli fans were assaulted by young people provoked by anti-Semitic social media posts. Authorities say five people are in the hospital. And tonight on EWTN News In Depth, an interview with the family of a hostage held by Hamas and his hopes that things may change with the new president. That's tonight on EWTN News In Depth at 8 p.m. Eastern. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including answered prayers, the role Pope John Paul II played in the fall of the Berlin Wall and victory over communism. And analysis on whether the incoming Trump administration will be able to secure the release of Catholic Jimmy Lai from a Hong Kong prison. Back today marks 35 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the beginning of the end of communism in Europe. The event was seen as an answer to prayers from then Pope John Paul II, a tireless fighter of communism. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Sittigren has more.
They saw the fall of the Berlin Wall on television. The whole thing seemed so surreal to me. You see people climbing over the wall. You see masses of people streaming from East Berlin to West Berlin. It was simply unbelievable.
On November 9, 1989, the iconic symbol of the Cold War division between the East and the West, the Berlin Wall, came down after 30 years of separating communism from democracy in Germany, eventually leading to the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of communism in Eastern Europe. Many believe this event would not have happened without the help of the Church, and of one pope in particular. As the late German Cardinal Joachim Meissner explained in an interview to EWTN, Pope St. John Paul II is credited with leading the peaceful revolution that toppled Soviet power.
John Paul II truly did change the world. Just think about it. Without him, there wouldn't have been a solidarity movement in Poland. I don't know if communism would have collapsed at all without John Paul II. So it's safe to say that we cannot overestimate John Paul II's role in the fall of communism.
John Paul II was the first pope to enter a communist country when he visited his native country of Poland in June of 1979, where he openly supported the Solidarity Movement, the Polish opposition to communism. On March 25, 1984, 3 years after surviving an assassination attempt, the Polish pope consecrated communist Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, following the request made by Our Lady of Fatima. In an interview with EWTN in 2016, St. John Paul II's former private secretary explained the great consequences of this consecration for Berlin and for the world.
I can only say what I have heard from the bishops of the Eastern countries. From this consecration, a process has begun that has ended with the freedom of those nations that were oppressed by communism and Marxism. For Our Lady both demanded and promised that freedom would then come. After this event, the world became a different world. Not only the fall of the Berlin Wall, not only the fall of the Iron Curtain, but also the fall of Marxism in the world, which was rooted above all in the universities and in circles all over the world.
In 1996, Pope St. John Paul II made his first visit to a reunified Germany. There, the Polish pope walked side by side with German Chancellor Helmut Kohl through the Brandenburg Gate and to what was once the inner German border. Speaking to the Germans in their own language, John Paul II gave a moving speech in which he encouraged them to never abandon hope for a life of freedom.
May God give you and your German fatherland the strength to complete this work.
In Rome, Benedictia de Grian, EWTN News Nightly.
Meantime, in Hong Kong, media mogul and pro-democracy advocate Catholic Jimmy Lai remains in a maximum security prison for charges related to violating the China-backed national security law. Now that Donald Trump is president-elect, Jimmy Lai's fate could change. In an interview before the November 5th presidential election, Trump told a podcast host that he would 100% get Jimmy Lai out of Hong Kong. And joining us now to talk more about this is Gordon Chang, author of the recently released Plan Red, China's Project to Destroy America, as well as The Coming Collapse of China and China is Going to War. Gordon, always great to be with you. So how likely do you think it is that President-elect Trump will be able to secure Jimmy Lai's release, and how quickly do you think it could possibly happen?
I think that it's likely that Jimmy Lai will be released. I don't know the timing, because I think that could take a fairly long period. But the point is that I think that Beijing does not want to hold on to Jimmy Lai because he's not in good health. And if he dies in prison, he becomes a symbol to people in Hong Kong. And that's the last thing that they want. Also, President Trump has a lot of leverage over the Chinese right now because of the economy. So I think that Xi Jinping is probably in the mood to accommodate President Trump's requests. And should he press this issue with Jimmy Lai, which I'm sure that he will, Jimmy Lai will be freed.
Yeah. Gordon, I want to talk about the economy in a minute, but I want to talk about the relationship right now between President-elect Trump and Xi Jinping, what it was like in the first Trump administration, and what do you think it'll be like in this next administration?
In the first administration, I think Xi Jinping was afraid of President Trump, and that was because when Xi Jinping was at Mar-a-Lago in April 2017, Trump stood up at dinner and said that he had just authorized a missile strike on Syria, which is a Chinese friend. Xi Jinping was flummoxed, he was quiet, and I think that set the tone for 4 years. Going forward, this 4 years, it'll be a bit different because Xi Jinping, I think, is almost in a panic about his economy. He knows he needs access to the U.S. market. He has got to be more accommodating to the U.S. and to his neighbors. This is going to be a very interesting dynamic as Xi Jinping tries to get through what could be a regime-ending crisis for Beijing.
Yeah, Gordon, let's talk about the economy and the proposed tariffs that Trump is planning to put on China on the imports. How likely do you think that will be that that will happen? And what kind of impact do you think that will have on China's economy if it does happen?
Yeah, if there are across-the-board tariffs on China, which I think will happen, it could very well drive the Chinese economy into the ground. Xi Jinping has turned his back on consumption as the basis for the Chinese economy, which means his only way out to rescue a grave situation is to export more to the world. He needs the U.S. market, the largest on the planet, and the other markets in the world are not big enough to make up for what would be losses if there were high across-the-board tariffs. We know one thing during the campaign, Tracy, and that is President Trump really believes in tariffs. So he will probably impose them on China, maybe even other countries as well.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much for weighing in. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Tracy.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Raised to Be Saints, a new book offers advice to families from the perspective of a seminary rector. Plus, how a bagel, baseball, and a bet raised $20,000 for Catholic education. Of National Vocation Awareness Week. The annual celebration is a time to learn more about the many forms of religious life, and a new book examines the formation of the faithful from the perspective of a seminary rector. Informing Families, Father Carter Griffin aims to give advice to parents on becoming saints and raising children to be saints. In the book, Father Griffin, rector of the St. John Paul II Seminary in the nation's capital, adapts the four pillars of priestly formation and applies them to family life. The book is filled with interviews from Catholic parents and examples from the lives of the saints. And Father Carter Griffin joins us now. He is, again, the rector of the St. John Paul II Seminary right here in the nation's capital, and also the author of the just-released book, Forming Families, Forming Saints. Father Griffin, great to have you on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Trace. It's good to be here.
Well,
so good.
So much to talk about. But first, talk to us about why you decided to write this book, Father, and why now?
Yeah. What's a celibate priest doing writing to parents about raising kids? I mean, I think I've been doing this work for a long time, 15 years almost, and I've just been so edified by the wisdom that the church has in forming priests and forming religious sisters and brothers. And in my conversations with a lot of married couples that I know, I've come to realize that a lot of what the church has learned about forming human beings is really helpful for parents, too. And so it'd never been done before, and I just thought it'd be a helpful, you know, it's not the whole picture, but there's some really important things that the church knows in formation and trying to convey those in a language that makes sense for parents in the 21st century.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and it is needed. I know the book also mentions the four pillars of priestly formation. Can you talk about that and how they can help, you know, in the family environment?
Yeah, sure. So the four pillars were actually sort of defined by St. John Paul II in a landmark document back in the early 1990s. And the first, the pillars are the human, the spiritual, the intellectual. And then in a seminary environment, the fourth one we call the pastoral pillar. But for the book, I turned it into apostolic, because the pastoral is more specifically about becoming a pastor. But the apostolic is the outward look, you know? And so what this does is it enables us to make sure that different areas of life, we can focus so much on one, say, just focus on the intellectual, or maybe even focus just on the spiritual. But if we're missing all four, then there's going to be gaps, and we're going to limp. And so making sure that each of those four areas, and so I break down the four areas into five chapters each, and I cover different things, order and chastity and the Eucharist and spiritual reading and all kinds of different, including setting up a vocations culture, really in the family, relevant for this week. So all these different areas and some lessons that we've learned from the seminary broken down into those 4 years to make sure that somebody is really growing on all fronts.
Yeah, that's so great. And it always starts in the family environment, too.
Yeah.
Tell us about the seminarians that you work with. Kind of give us an idea of who they are, their backgrounds, and why they chose the vocation.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think our seminary, it's a sort of a mid-size or a college seminary where 45 to 50 guys, say, in an average year. From different dioceses, mainly from this general area. But I find that the men, and I visit a lot of other seminaries and am in touch with a lot of other rectors, and know that I think that they would feel the same way, that the young men coming into the seminary are very edifying in many respects. They are committed to the church. They're faithful. They're zealous. They're open and transparent. They really want to be formed. And I think the future looks very, very hopeful and bright when you see. I mean, the numbers are not obviously where we'd like them to be, but the quality is very good. Obviously, they're coming from a culture that is in many ways very wounded, hence the book. But we also have a lot more resources and I think a lot more knowledge than even just a couple of decades ago about how to address some of those wounds. And so the church takes her time in forming priests in particular and religious sisters and brothers. But the quality of the men coming in and the families that are sending them are just top-notch, and I can't say enough about them.
Almost out of time, but quickly, what advice would you give to those that are considering a vocation?
I think the most important thing is don't do it alone. Find somebody, a spiritual mentor who can walk with you, a parish priest, for instance. And above all, don't do it alone. Bring Jesus into this. Like, have an interior life, making sure you're getting to the sacraments, Mass and confession, having a prayer life, spiritual reading, being close to Our Lady. These are the staples, the bread and butter of the interior life, but they're also the bread and butter of discerning a vocation well. And it's the most extraordinary, beautiful life imaginable. So if you do have a vocation to the priesthood, at least I can speak for that, you've kind of won the jackpot.
Now, Father, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about all this. We appreciate it. God bless you.
Thanks, Tracy.
Finally tonight, thanks to the Los Angeles Dodgers, the head of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles is about to enjoy some really delicious New York bagels. This comes after Cardinal Timothy Dolan placed a friendly wager with Archbishop Jose Gomez ahead of the World Series, won by the Dodgers 4-1. The two also raised, get this, around $20,000 for Catholic schools in both cities. Cardinal Gomez will receive his bagels next week during the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Fall Assembly. Ollie, thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.